Well, I had a birthday about a week ago. Thank you. I wasn't saying that for y'all to say happy birthday to me. I was just saying that because it gets me into what I'm about to say. I turned 53 years old, 53 years old about 9 days ago. And I know y'all are all sitting there looking, man, I would have thought he was about 32. I know that's what you're all thinking. But I have a streak going in my life, okay? A 53-year-old streak going in my life. And I'm not sure if it's a winning streak or a losing streak, okay? And maybe some of y'all can help me figure that out after church this morning. I'll be out in the Welcome Center. If you think this is a winning streak or a losing streak, you come and let me know, okay? But for the 53rd straight year, I did not make the world's 10 most beautiful people list. I am hurt by that. I cannot understand it. I mean, y'all all acknowledge I look like I'm about 32 years old, and yet for 53 straight years, I didn't make the world's most beautiful people list. I think maybe some people have a messed up definition of what beautiful is. Beauty is one of those issues, it's one of those subjects that we really don't know what to do with. We really don't know what to make of it because we know that we're really not supposed to make a lot of it, but we do make a lot of it. And you can tell that by the way that we talk about it. Because we say things about beauty, things like, everybody's beautiful in their own way. Y'all remember that song? Everybody's beautiful. I'm not going to sing for you. That's Mark's department. But everybody's beautiful in their own way. And you know what that's saying? That's just another way of saying some of you aren't too good looking. I mean, that's really just another way of saying that, isn't it? Or we say things like beauty is in the eye of the beholder. And what we're saying there is beauty is a very subjective thing. And as I look at things, you don't look so hot. You know, that's just another way of saying that. And so you can understand by the way that we talk about this subject of beauty, we really don't know what to do about it. We don't want to elevate it, but we know that we live in a society that does. And so we have trouble figuring out how do we downplay it and do it in the right way. You've also heard somebody say, you know, you've heard people say beauty is only skin deep. And for some of us, it doesn't even go that far. For some of us, though, we think it goes all the way to the core, and it's all who it's completely who we are. It's our complete identity. Now, I'm not talking about myself there, obviously, but, you know, there are people in this world who think, well, hey, I'm one of the beautiful people. And they think because they're one of the beautiful people, that makes them one of the privileged people. And that means they get to live life by their own definitions and their own standards and their own way of doing things, and they think it makes them special. They think it makes them unique, and it makes them something, but I don't know what it is. But beauty is just one of those subjects that we really don't know what to do with. But I think all of us are smart enough to understand, and actually in the last month on Wednesday nights I talked a little bit about this, but I think all of us are smart enough to understand that an attractive exterior oftentimes just covers up an ugly or not so good interior. Can we all agree on that? Sometimes, you know, just the outward beauty, really all it does is it camouflages the fact that there's nothing on the inside of any real value or worth. I think about fruit when I think of that because, you know, all fruit seems to look good on the outside, doesn't it? But have you ever gotten a piece of fruit and you thought, man, that is a good... Oranges are the most deceptive fruit to me out of all of them. Now, I love oranges. How many of y'all like oranges? I love oranges. But they're the most deceptive fruit because, you know, every orange you see in the grocery store looks like the perfect orange, doesn't it? And you think, man, I'm going to get that orange, and I'm going to peel that orange, and I'm going to bite into it, and it's going to be so sweet, and it's going to be so juicy. It's just going to be so perfect. I'm just going to love eating that orange. But there have been many times when I've peeled an orange and bitten into it, and it either wasn't very juicy or it wasn't very sweet. And I thought, man, it looks so good on the outside, but what was on the inside didn't match what was on the outside. We all know you can't judge a book by its cover, and you can't judge an orange by its peel either, can you? And you can't judge a person by their looks. Because we've all known people who seemed on the outside to have it all going for them. They were one of the beautiful people. They were one of the intelligent people. They were one of the popular people. They were one of the talented people. They just had that charisma, you know, that personality that just sort of brought everybody to life or just lit up a room or took over a room. But then when you got to know them, you began to realize, you know, yeah, it looks good on the outside, but as I get to know this person, the character, there just doesn't seem to be any core to their life. Something seems to be missing. Something doesn't seem to add up here. They're one of those people that just sort of takes over a room, but when you get beneath the surface and the superficial, you kind of go, I don't get it. I don't see what the attraction is here, and there really isn't any attraction. Because there are many people who have it all going for them on the outside, but on the inside, there's not a lot there. They haven't developed a real character, what we in the church would call a Christian, godly, biblical character. There's nothing that gives weight and meaning to their lives. I want to let y'all know what I've been doing in the last few times that I've preached here on Sunday mornings. I've been actually preaching a series that I preached years ago at a previous church, and the title of it, this is such a clever title, it was titled Bad Hair Days. Okay? And any of y'all ever had a bad hair day? I don't have enough hair to have a bad hair day, and many of the men are like that, but it was a series about characters in the Bible who their story sort of revolved around hair. They were hairy people. So last time I preached on Esau, today we're going to talk about Absalom. And he was a man who didn't have a real core to his life. And you know people like that. There are people who have nothing, don't have anything that gives any real weight or meaning to their lives. And unfortunately, they didn't seem to realize it. Or maybe they realized it, and what they were doing is they were using that charisma, that personality, that intellect, those good looks to hide what they didn't want people to see. Have you ever known someone like that? I hesitate to ask this question, but have you ever been that person? Have you ever been that person who hid what you didn't want people to see on the inside by trying to just look good on the outside? To be honest with you, that's our default position as human beings. Our default position is to try to make you think something about me that may not necessarily be true, because I don't really want you to know my core. Well, see, the beauty of being a Christian is that we don't have to worry about that. We can simply be open and honest with one another, because we have to be open and honest with God. We live in a world that values and emphasizes the surface and the superficial qualities. Things like beauty, things like talent, charm, charisma, ability. And the truth is that you can get by on those things, because there are a lot of people who have. You can get by with some of the superficial, surface characteristics, those kind of things that I just mentioned. You can get by with it. Some people get by with it for a long time. But eventually it will catch up to you. Eventually people will come to understand that's really all there is. And we've seen it catch up with a lot of people. We, you know, when we think about this issue, we start to think, well, you know, who are those people? And we think about, well, athletes, movie stars, musicians, politicians, corporate CEOs that are making millions of dollars every year. We think, yeah, those are the people who are getting away with, you know, just sort of the show and being the shadow and not ever really revealing their core. And then you find out, well, there's really nothing to their life. And it certainly is true of all those people, but you know where else this shows up? It shows up in contractors and managers and plumbers and accountants and preachers and high school students. In other words, this issue of getting by on the surface, superficial qualities of life, when maybe there's really no core to your life, it's not a product of modern society. It's a product of the human heart that's been around forever. And so as we talk about Absalom today, that's what we're going to see. We're going to see a man that I call a rebel without a core. He was a rebel without a core. Let's talk a little bit about Absalom. You've probably heard his story. Absalom was David's third son, and he was the son who caused the most anguish and the most problems in David's life. Absalom's story is the story of a man who was able to get by on his good looks and his popularity and his charisma, and he just had that personality that he could get away with things and he could manipulate people and he could just sort of get done what he wanted to do. He could fulfill his own self-serving purposes because of that image that he had. But then as we sort of walk through his story this morning in 2 Samuel, we'll see, but that's all there was to him, was just that surface stuff. And there really wasn't anything on the inside that gave his life weight and meaning. Absalom was a master of pretense and keeping up appearances. He was a master of disguise. Absalom was the kind of guy who was sort of like a magician, sort of a Houdini. You know, he let you see what he wanted you to see. And there are a lot of folks like that. See, Absalom was not one of those men that you would have said about him, what you see is what you get. Those are the kind of people that I like to know and like to deal with, because it's like, hey, you know, when you see them, what you see is what you get. There's no pretense there. They're not just putting on a show for you. When you meet this person, when you know this person, when you have a relationship with that person, you're getting them. You're not getting a show. So Absalom wasn't the kind of guy that you said, well, you know, what you see is what you get. Absalom was the kind of the guy that where you would say, what you see is what I want you to see so I can get what I want. And that's the characteristics of Absalom's life. I think that's at the heart of his story. What you see is what I want you to see so that I can get what I want from you and for myself. You've probably known people that talk all the time because as long as they're talking, they don't have to really reveal anything. And as long as they're talking, it keeps them from having to do the thing they hate the most, and that's listen. Have you ever known somebody who talks and you go, I'm not sure he's trying to say anything as much as he's trying to cover up a lot of stuff? And sometimes we're like that, aren't we? You see, that's pretense. That's putting out a false image. That's, I don't want you to know what's in here because there's not a whole lot in there. And so I'm going to put on this show for you out here. And that was Absalom. Absalom was putting on the show out there so that he could hide what was in here. So let's look at a few facts about Absalom. What we're going to do, I'm going to read three or four passages here real quickly that just sort of give us, you know, just some brief highlights of Absalom's life. And then we're going to go back, and I'm just going to walk us through. I'm not going to read all of this because this is five chapters. This is 2 Samuel chapter 13 through verse 18. I'll give you a homework assignment. When you go home today, after you've gotten through all your Mother's Day meal and all that kind of stuff, if you want to fill in the details, which I would highly encourage you to do, read 2 Samuel 13 through 18. It's the story of Absalom and his relationship with David and his rebellion, okay? But we're just going to mention a few verses here, so that we get an understanding of Absalom and his character. So the first thing we're going to do is look at 2 Samuel chapter 14, verses 25 and 26. 2 Samuel 14, verses 25 and 26. And it says, in all Israel there was not a man so highly praised for his handsome appearance as Absalom. Now listen to this. Ladies, don't swoon over this, okay? From the top of his head to the sole of his foot, there was no blemish in him. He was the Brad Pitt, George Clooney, whoever's popular today of his day, okay? From the top of his head to the bottom of his feet, there was no blemish in him. He was it. He was the man. He had the looks, okay? And then it goes on and says, Whenever he cut the hair of his head, he used to cut his hair from time to time when it became too heavy for him. Wouldn't some of us like to have that problem? He would weigh it, and its weight was 200 shekels by the royal standard. So here you have Absalom. Absalom, he made the 10 most beautiful people list every year of his life. I mean, he just had it. I mean, rarely do you see the Bible give a description of somebody's physical appearance, but Absalom in his physical appearance was so outstanding, so much a pretty boy, that the writer of 2 Samuel records in there, he was the best looking guy in town. And that was his identity. And he obviously had this long flowing golden locks, and every now and then it would just get too heavy for him and he would cut it off. I don't know if he gave it to make wigs or clothes or what, but you know, he would cut his hair every now and then. And so everybody just thought, man, Absalom, he is just so pretty to look at. And all the guys were probably like, oh, there's Absalom again, you know. But he was a pretty boy. But now look at this. You would think that would mean he has everything going for him. But we see something else over in 2 Samuel chapter 17 that is a key characteristic or is a key in helping us understand Absalom's life. 2 Samuel chapter 17, verse 14. Look at what this says. Now, we'll kind of touch on some of this story in a minute, but let me just read this verse to you. It says, Absalom and all the men of Israel said, and this is where he's getting advice on whether or not to pursue his father David as he started this rebellion. It says, the advice of Hushai the Archite is better than that of Ahithophel. Now look at what this says. For the Lord had determined to frustrate the good advice of Ahithophel. And here's the phrase, in order to bring disaster on Absalom. So Absalom was so rebellious and so messed up in his relationship, not only with his family, but with God, that God determined, I am going to bring disaster on Absalom. Now, all of us have problems in our life, but listen, if God has made up his mind that he's going to bring disaster on you, you've got a real problem because you somewhere have really messed up. Because God's not typically in the business of bringing disaster on his people. Somehow you've gotten way out of line if God has determined in his heart and mind that he's going to bring disaster on you. But that's where Absalom found himself. And as you read the story of Absalom, you find that disaster is exactly what comes to Absalom's life. And so God, he was in such a condition that God himself opposed him. But let's move on now to 2 Samuel chapter 18. We're going to read about four or five verses here. And this is the end of Absalom's life. And this last verse that we'll read sort of sums up Absalom. 2 Samuel chapter 18, begin in verse 9. And this is where, now Absalom is in open rebellion against David, and his forces are fighting David's forces. And this is the end of his life. In verse 9, it says, now Absalom happened to meet David's men. He was riding his mule, and as the mule went under the thick branches of a large oak, Absalom's head, now some translations say that his hair, remember that long hair that he has, it says Absalom's head or his hair got caught in the tree, and he was left hanging in midair while the mule he was riding kept on going. When one of the men saw this, he told Joab, that's David's general, he said, I just saw Absalom hanging in an oak tree. Now move down to verse 14 and 15. Here's what Joab says. Because this man that saw him hanging said, I'm not killing the king's son. But Joab doesn't have a problem with that. Look at what it says, verse 14. Joab said, I'm not going to wait like this for you. So he took three javelins in his hand and plunged them into Absalom's heart while Absalom was still alive in the oak tree. And 10 of Joab's armor bearers surrounded Absalom, struck him, and killed him. So they killed him while he's hanging there in this tree. So Absalom's dead. Now here's what, in the end, is said about Absalom. Look at chapter 18. Verse 18, 2 Samuel 18, 18, it says, during his lifetime, Absalom had taken a pillar and erected it in the king's valley as a monument to himself. For he thought, I have no son to carry on the memory of my name. And he named the pillar after himself, and it is called Absalom's Monument to this day. So all Absalom was the kind of guy that at the end of the day, all that there was to remember him by was a slab of stone set up as a monument to who? Himself. That characterizes Absalom's life, because he was a rebel who did things his way with no thought to anyone else. The only authority he had in his life was himself. It wasn't going to be his father. It wasn't going to be God. It was simply going to be Absalom. We see that in some of the trouble that he caused his family. And so we're going to go back now and talk about a couple of episodes from his life real quickly. I'm just going to summarize this for you. This first part is in 2 Samuel chapter 13. And it's the story of Amnon and Tamar. Absalom had a sister named Tamar. And evidently they came from a very good gene pool, because Tamar was quite the looker herself. She was a beautiful, beautiful lady according to 2 Samuel. Amnon, Absalom's half-brother, David's son, was full of lust and desire for Tamar. And so Amnon comes up with this elaborate scheme to get Tamar to come to his home, and he lures her into a situation in his bedroom where they're alone, and he rapes her. Absalom, the brother of Tamar, found out about it. And Absalom, what he did is he told Tamar, because obviously the shame that she was experiencing, he said, "Don't say anything about it. Just let it go." And what Absalom did is for 2 years, he just let the anger and the bitterness and the rage and the sense of vengeance build up in him. And finally, after 2 years, Absalom went to his father David and said, "Hey, Dad, I'd like to have kind of a family get together. And I'd like to have you and all my siblings come over to my house, and we'll just have a big feast." And David said, "Well, Absalom, that's a nice offer, but you know, it would just be such a burden for all of us to come. I don't think we ought to do that, and I'm not going to come." And Absalom said, "Well, okay, Dad, that's okay if you don't want to come, but how about if I invite all my brothers and sisters, and especially Amnon? Would you tell Amnon especially to be there?" Now remember, this is 2 years later. And David says, "Hey, it's okay with me." And so Absalom has this party, and all the siblings come, and Amnon is there. And Absalom had told his servants, he said, "Now y'all watch me, because when I give the signal, I want you to kill Amnon, because he raped my sister Tamar." And you know what? That's exactly what he did. He had this party, and Amnon came, and he had Amnon killed. So Absalom took the law into his own hands. The law didn't call for that. The law called for Amnon either to marry Tamar or to pay his father or her father a dowry. It didn't, and you can tell that the law didn't call for that, because what did Absalom do after he had Amnon killed? He did what anybody would have done. He ran. Because he knew what he had done was wrong. And so he ran and he hid. But Amnon only answered to himself, see, because there was nothing in his mind greater than himself, and so it was all about him. Now here's our point. When there is no core to your life that is greater than you are, and there is no core to my life that is greater than I am, in other words, someone or something outside of us, then you and I become the ultimate authority. Now, if that sounds familiar, it is, because that's the world that we live in. There's no core, there's nothing outside of me that determines what's right and wrong. And so if I'm the ultimate authority in my life and you're the ultimate authority in your life, what's always going to happen? We're always going to have conflict. We're always going to be butting up against one another, because what you think is right may not be what I think is right, and I don't care what you think is right if it doesn't line up with what I think is right. And that's exactly how Absalom lived his life. And the truth of the matter is that as human beings, throughout history, ever since the fall of man, the quest has been to somehow eliminate outside authority so that I can be my own authority. The quest has always been to somehow eliminate somebody else's definition of right and wrong so that I can define what's right and wrong. Because what happens when you define what's right and wrong for you? You get to do whatever you want to, don't you? You get to do whatever you want to. If I can define what's right and wrong for me, I get to do whatever I want to. It doesn't matter to me what you think. Because if I'm the ultimate authority, then I'm the ultimate authority. And you have nothing to say to me. And I don't have to listen to you. You know, if you in your relationships are always butting heads with other people, and you always somehow find a way to say it's them, I just want to gently say to you, you may want to reevaluate, because the problem may be you. The problem may be you, just like the problem may be me when I constantly butt heads with people. Whether it's my wife or coworkers or friends or just people I pass on the street. And so if all that is in my heart is me and all that's in your heart is you, then there's going to be continual conflict. And that's what Absalom found in his life, because all that was in his heart was him. He was one of the beautiful people. He was one of the people that everybody looked at and said, oh man, Absalom, he's really got it together. And he had conflict after conflict, and it's especially unfolded, and we're given it in the context of his family in 2 Samuel. But ultimately, Absalom didn't just reject his family and reject his father David, he rejected God. That's ultimately what was going on in Absalom's life, because Absalom literally did what Absalom wanted to do. Before we get to the second part of the story, just let me tell you this. Later on, of course, Absalom ran, and David said, I don't ever want to see him again the rest of my life. And so Absalom ran to a place called Geshur, and he stayed there. And finally, you know, he eventually wanted to come back and be part of the family and all that kind of stuff. And finally, Joab convinced David to let him come back. And so Absalom comes back, and he lives in Jerusalem for a couple of years, and he finally says, you know, I'm ready to see Dad again. Why won't the king see me? And so he tries to get Joab to come and go to the king on his behalf, but Joab wouldn't go. And he sends another contingent of people to say, hey, Joab, come over here. I want to talk to you about something. I want you to go talk to my dad. And Joab doesn't come. And so finally what Absalom does, he says, hey, guys, these are his servants. He says, hey, guys, Joab's field is right next to my field, and I need to get him to talk to me. So here's what I want y'all to do. His field is full of barley. I want y'all to go set his field on fire. And that's exactly what his servants did. He went to the extent of setting a man's field on fire just to get this man to come and do something that Absalom wanted him to do. And so finally Joab does come, and he does go and talk to the king, and David sort of reconciles with Absalom. But the story doesn't stop there, because we're told in 2 Samuel chapter 15, and I want to read these verses to you so that we get this. This is right after David has sort of forgiven Absalom. And here's how Absalom responds. 2 Samuel 15, beginning in verse 1. It says, in the course of time, Absalom provided himself with a chariot and horses and with 50 men to run ahead of him. So he gets him this group, you know, this group of guys to sort of be his roadies and that kind of thing. And he says, verse 2 says, he would get up early and stand by the side of the road leading to the city gate. And whenever anyone came with a complaint to be placed before the king for a decision, Absalom would call out to him, hey, what town are you from? And he would answer, your servant is from one of the tribes of Israel. Then Absalom would say to him, look, your claims are valid and proper, but there's no representative of the king to hear you. And Absalom would add, if only I were appointed judge in the land, then everyone who has a complaint or cause could come to me and I would see that he gets justice. Also, whenever anyone approached him to bow down before him, Absalom would reach out his hand, take hold of him, and kiss him. Absalom behaved in this way toward all the Israelites who came to the king asking for justice. And listen to this. And he stole the hearts of the men of Israel. At the end of 4 years, Absalom said to the king, let me go to Hebron and fulfill a vow I made to the Lord. While your servant was living at Geshur in Aram, I made this vow. If the Lord takes me back to Jerusalem, I will worship the Lord in Hebron. Now, I'm going to read the rest of this in just a second, but let me tell you what's going on. He's not going back to make some sort of sacrifice or to fulfill a vow. He's going back to have himself appointed king. Because Absalom has decided he doesn't need God's king anymore. So let's pick the story back up. And in verse 9 it says, the king said to him, go in peace. So he went to Hebron. Then Absalom sent secret messengers throughout the tribes of Israel to say, as soon as you hear the sound of the trumpets, then say, Absalom is king in Hebron. 200 men from Jerusalem had accompanied Absalom. They had been invited as guests and went quite innocently, knowing nothing about the matter. While Absalom was offering sacrifices, he also sent for Ahithophel the Gilonite, David's counselor, to come from Gilo, his hometown. And so the conspiracy gained strength, and Absalom's following kept on increasing. Do you see what Absalom's doing there? His father David literally kissed him to say, son, I forgive you. Now, they weren't fully reconciled, but there was something of restoration in the relationship. And what does Absalom do? He turns around and he starts this conspiracy and this rebellion against his father. So instead of responding with gratitude, Absalom starts trying to turn the people against David, and he plants the seeds of rebellion. And what Absalom was doing is he was revolting, he was rebelling against really God's authority in his life. Because who had appointed and anointed and really chosen David as king? God had. God had put David on the throne. And Absalom, in doing what he was doing, was saying, God, I reject your king. I don't need your king. I think I would make a better king than yours. And I'm going to get rid of him and make myself king. You see, Absalom probably thought he was just rebelling against his father, but he really was rebelling against God. When you and I rebel against any God-given authority in our life, we're rebelling against God. We're rebelling against God. You may think you're rebelling against somebody that you just don't like, or you may think you're rebelling against somebody who's incompetent or who just doesn't let you do what you want to do, and therefore it's okay. But when you rebel against any God-given authority in your life, you're rebelling against God. Teenagers sitting over in the Family Life Center, I hate to be the one to tell you this, but when you rebel against your parents, and you think, oh, they're just a bunch of old geezers. They don't know what it's like to be young. You know, they don't know what it's like to have the pressures of a cell phone and Facebook and Twitter, and they just don't understand, you know, and I'm just going to do my own thing because they just don't get it. I'm going to tell you, kids, when you rebel against your parents, you are rebelling against God. And you can try to explain it any way you want to. But when you rebel against your parents, and they're not always right. I'm not always right. I know that. But when you rebel against your parents, kids, you're rebelling against God. And if you're a believer, if you're a follower of Jesus Christ, it's very plain and simple. That's wrong. That's wrong. You just don't do that. Now, well, you know, I know you've got a million questions and all that kind of stuff. It's just, hey, wait your turn. You'll be a parent someday. But when you rebel against God-given authority in your life, whether you're a teenager or whether you're 40 or 82, it's wrong. Because not everything's about you. Not everything's about you. See, Absalom didn't get that. Because Absalom wanted to be his own king. And here's one of the fundamental truths you have to understand about life. You don't get to be your own king. You just don't. None of us gets to be our own king. We want to, we try to, but you can't make yourself the final authority. Now let me tie this to us as Christians, New Testament believers. You see, that's the core of who we are as Christians. Is we come to a point where we say, I don't get to be my own king. See, if you've never come to that point where you realized you don't get to be your own king, and you've accepted God's king, Jesus Christ, then you're not a Christian. I know that sounds exclusive, and it is. but it's very simple. There is a king that we all must surrender to, and his name is Jesus. His name is Jesus. And you don't get to be the authority. You don't get to be your own Savior. You can't be your own Savior. See, if I'm the final authority, then I don't need a Savior and I don't need a king. All I need is an explanation and an excuse. And I can always find an explanation. I can always find an excuse. And I can always find somebody. I'll say, well, yeah, Ken, you're right in that. But I can be just as wrong as I've ever been. We don't get to be our own king. We can't live our lives like Absalom and be our own authority. The truth is, some of you sitting in this room and over in the Family Life Center today are trying to live life according to your own terms. You're trying to get by just on the superficial qualities. You may have talent, you may have charisma, you may have looks. You've got something going for you, and you are riding that horse as far as it's going to take you. But I'm going to tell you, it's going to break down sooner or later. It's going to break down sooner or later. And then you've got to know there is a core to my life. There is a core to my life that's eternal. And I'll tell you what that core is. That core is Jesus. That core is Jesus. And when you invite him into your life has weight and meaning and eternal value and eternal purpose. And it begins when you say, you know, I'm not the authority anymore, because there is one who is greater than me, who is outside of me, who has a better understanding of how this all needs to work out and come together. And his name is Jesus, and I want him as my Lord and Savior. Will you pray with me as we close?